Thank you for standing by, and welcome to the repeat session of 2020 Chemical Data Reporting Requirements. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. To ask a question during the session, you will need to press star 1 on your telephone. If you require any further assistance, please press star 0. I would now like to hand the conference over to your speaker today, Ms. Meredith Kalm. Please go ahead.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for calling in today. We appreciate your patience and willingness to participate in this webinar. My name is Meredith Combs. I'm in the Office of Pollution Prevention and Toxics here at the EPA. I'll be presenting today along with my colleague Tom Smith and Carolina Filele, who is a contractor with CGI Federal. Today, we will be providing an overview of the 2020 chemical data reporting collection period, which begins this year on June 1st, 2020. The way this webinar will function is that we ask that you follow along with the PDF version of the slides that we have provided you in the confirmation email that you received either last night or this morning. You must download these from the EPA website, and they have two different titles. The first one is called CDR Regulatory Overview, and the second one is called the CDR Reporting Tool Walkthrough. So the two different files represent the two parts of the webinar. Right now, I'm looking at the title page of the first of those two documents. So again, I'm looking at the title page for the document titled CDR Regulatory Overview. Before moving on to each slide, I will indicate what slide number I am on. So right now I'm on the title slide, and starting on the next slide, you will see the slide number in the lower right-hand corner. So right now I'm moving on to slide one of the first document. You can see in the lower right-hand corner the number indicating what slide we are on. Here's an overview of our presentation. Today's presentation will last about 2 hours and have two parts. The first part will be background on TSCA, the Chemical Data Reporting Program, and an overview of the reporting requirements. Second, we will have a walkthrough with screenshots of the reporting tool. If time allows, we will have a question and answer section at the end. I'm now transitioning to slide two. Here I'll provide some history on the Toxic Substances Control Act, which we abbreviate as TSCA and call TSCA. TSCA is the premier chemical safety legislation in the U.S. It gives EPA the authority to require reporting, record keeping and testing requirements, and restrictions related to chemical substances and or mixtures. TSCA was initially passed in 1976 and most recently updated in 2016 with the Frank R. Lautenberg Chemical Safety for the 21st Century Act, which we abbreviate as the Lautenberg Act. For the Chemical Data Reporting Program, we are focused on substances that are listed on the TSCA inventory. The TSCA inventory is a comprehensive listing of chemicals in commerce in the U.S. This was created in the late 1970s and currently lists 85,000 chemical substances, with about 42,000 of them identified as being active in commerce. I am now transitioning to slide three and provide a quick overview of the Chemical Data Reporting Program, which we abbreviate as CDR. CDR is really a first look or high-level view of chemicals in commerce in the U.S., and it is essential for the work that we do here at EPA. CDR is a collection of basic exposure-related information on the types, quantities, and uses of chemical substances manufactured domestically or imported into the United States. This applies only to chemical substances listed on the TSCA inventory, and certain classes of chemicals are exempted from reporting. The information is submitted every 4 years, which most recently happened in 2016, and the current submission period, which we are preparing to open up, will begin on June 1st, 2020, and will cover and collect information from the calendar years between 2016 and 2019. Many of you are likely familiar with the CDR revisions rule, which was finalized this month, or I'm sorry, actually last month now, in March of 2020. The finalization of this rule will affect the CDR reporting requirements, and we will go into more detail on that in this presentation. It is also important to note that we have extended the end of the submission period from September 30th to November 30th to provide additional time for reporters to become familiar with these new requirements. We are also in the process of finalizing the small manufacturing definition, which has been proposed but not yet finalized. I'm now transitioning to slide four. Here I'll go into more detail on what was included in the final CDR revisions rule, of which will certain provisions of which will affect this reporting period. There were three main goals for the revisions rule. First, update CDR to align with the new statutory requirements for TSCA. CDR is essential for the implementation of TSCA here at the agency, and we are constantly evaluating our data needs. So the second goal was to improve the CDR data to support the implementation of TSCA. And third, we had the goal of reducing burden for certain CDR reporters. In order to meet these goals, the summary of the changes we made are exemptions of reporting certain byproducts, changes to claiming confidentiality to align with the Lautenberg Act, modifications to reportable data elements, and changes to simplifying reporting processes for co-manufactured chemicals. I would also like to note that in this presentation, any green text indicates a new reporting requirement or an updated reporting requirement. So that is just to help you as we go through the slides today, that you can keep track of what's going to be different this submission period from prior submission periods. And also, if you use these as a reference at a later date, just keep that in mind, that any green text is new or updated. I'm now on slide 5. This is just a title slide indicating that we are moving to the portion of the presentation in which I will be discussing the 2020 reporting requirements. I'm now on slide 6, and I would just like to first point out that the submission period will be from June 1st to November 30th of this year. Again, the end of the submission period is an extension of how long it's been in the past. This is for manufacturers, which under TSCA includes importers of chemical substances that are listed on the TSCA inventory as of June 1st, 2020, have a production volume of 25,000 pounds or greater at a site in at least one of the years from 2016 through 2019, unless they are subject to certain TSCA actions in which the production volume is lower at 2,500 pounds or greater. You are also required to report if you are not eligible for a full or partial exemption from the CDR. I'm now on slide 7. For each chemical that is reported, certain information is required, including the annual production volume from 2016 through 2019, certain manufacturing information for 2019, processing and use information for 2019, and certain exemptions may reduce reporting, which will be explained later in this presentation. All submissions are sent to EPA electronically through EPA's Central Data Exchange, which is also called CDX, in which an individual must register with CDX, access the eCDR web, which is the CDR reporting tool, create and submit a separate Form U for each site, and submit Form U's following instructions on eCDR web. I'm now transitioning to slide 8. We will now move through an exercise to determine your need to report. You must consider each chemical substance that you domestically manufactured or imported at a single site from 2016 through 2019. And you must consider, first, is your chemical substance subject to CDR? And second, are you a manufacturer that is required to report? I am now on slide 9. Here are some other things to consider when determining your need to report to the CDR. First, is your chemical substance listed on the TSCA inventory? Is your chemical substance manufactured for commercial purposes, which means to import, produce, or manufacture with the purpose of obtaining an immediate or eventual commercial advantage for the manufacturer? Next, is your chemical substance used only for non-TSCA uses, as defined by Section 32B? Next, is your chemical substance potentially exempt from reporting, or is your chemical substance ineligible for an exemption? I am now on slide 10. Here is an overview of chemical-specific exemptions, which are outlined in the CFR at 40 CFR 711.6. Some chemicals are fully exempt from reporting, such which includes polymers, microorganisms, and certain forms of natural gas and water, as well as naturally occurring chemical substances. Some chemicals are partially exempt from processing and use reporting. This includes listed petroleum processing streams, and chemicals whose processing and use information is of low current interest. Some chemicals are not eligible for exemptions if they're subject to certain TSCA actions. So let's transition to slide 11. I'm now on slide 11. This is a chart which shows the list of TSCA actions that would make your chemical ineligible for an exemption. And it's a bit difficult to see here, but the Section 4 orders, that is a green check mark, so that indicates that is a new requirement for this reporting period. I am now transitioning to slide 12. Here on slide 12, I'm going to look at a chemical-specific example and determine if this chemical is subject to the CDR. This is a screenshot from the Substance Registry Service, the link of which is on the bottom of the slide. Tom is going to go over in more detail how to best use our SRS, but I just for now want to explain that I've searched the SRS for a generic CAS number 123456, and this is an output of the regulations that this chemical is subject to. So if we transition to slide 13, now on slide 13, we can see that this chemical is subject to the 2016 TSCA inventory and therefore is subject to the CDR. Let's transition to slide 14. We would just like to note that these examples in this presentation will still refer to 2016, which was the last reporting period. But before the June 1st reporting period opens up this year, we will have updated information for 2020, which includes two lists in the SRS to indicate if the chemical is active or inactive on the TSCA inventory. I'm now transitioning to slide 15. We will now evaluate the production volume threshold for your chemical and determine if it is required to be reported to the CDR. Remember that the production volume threshold for chemicals is at 25,000 pounds, or for certain TSCA actions, it triggers a lower reporting threshold at 2,500 pounds. You must consider the production volume for each of the calendar years of the reporting period. So that means for this reporting period, that is 2016, 2017, 2018, and 2019. I'm now transitioning to slide 16. Let's evaluate the production volume of a sample company. So here we have a sample company called Chem Inc. A, and they manufacture three chemicals, Chem A, Chem B, and Chem C. So for this example, let's assume that these chemicals are not subject to certain TSCA actions and the lower reporting threshold. For Chem A, in 2016, 2017, and 2018, the production volume was under 25,000 pounds, but in 2019, it exceeded 25,000 pounds. This makes the company required to report on this chemical. For Chem B, we see that in 2016, 2018, and 2019, they actually did not produce this chemical at all. But in 2017, they made the chemical and it exceeded the 25,000 pound production volume threshold. Therefore, they must report on this chemical. For Chemical C, we can see that in all 4 years, they did not meet the reporting threshold and therefore are not required to report. I'm transitioning to slide 17. In general, the reporting threshold remains at 25,000 pounds. However, a reduced reporting threshold at 2,500 pounds applies to chemicals subject to certain TSCA actions. And let's transition to slide 18. Here on slide 18, you can see is a table of actions that TSCA actions that would trigger the lower reporting threshold. So the first three TSCA actions do not affect the reporting threshold, but the remainder in this chart do. And again, the Section 4 orders, that is a green check mark in the middle of the chart here, so that is a new requirement. I am now on slide 19. We're checking in again with our generic chemical CAS number 123456, and here is an output of the regulations it is subject to, and I want you to take a look and see if there are any TSCA actions that would result in triggering the lower reporting threshold for the substance. So if we transition to slide 20, we see a circle around TSCA Section 6 unreasonable risk, so that would trigger the lower reporting threshold. I am now on slide 21, so we are going to circle back in on Chem Inc. A. So we've already talked about the first three chemicals that they manufacture, Chem A, B, and C. They also manufactured three more chemicals, Chem D, E, and F. And these three chemicals are subject to certain TSCA actions, so we'll go over that in more detail. For Chemical D, we see that they are subject to the TSCA Section 6 rule, which triggers a lower reporting threshold. And in 2017, we see that they manufacture 3,000 pounds, which makes them required to report on this chemical. For Chemical E, even though Chemical E is also subject to the same TSCA action, we see it is not reportable because it does not meet or exceed the lower reporting threshold. So in none of the years did they exceed 2,500 pounds. For Chemical F, it is also subject to the TSCA Section 5 SNR, And we see that in 2018 and 2019, they exceeded the lower reporting threshold of 2,500 pounds, and they are required to report on this chemical. I'm now transitioning to slide 22. We'll cover whether you exempt as a small manufacturer and if you qualify for any other reporting exemptions. And we'll focus later on the new byproduct specific exemptions. So I've now transitioned to slide 23. As I mentioned earlier, we have proposed a small manufacturer definition, which has not yet been finalized. So EPA proposed this based on the update of the current two standard definition on inflation by adjusting the sales standard level. So this means that we would raise the current size standard total annual sales based on the $4 million to $11 million and the production volume modified standard equivalently from $40 million to $110 million with no change in the modifier of 100,000 pounds. And just to clarify, the total annual sales are a submitter combined with a parent company, whether foreign or domestic. We also propose to change the inflation index to determine future changes to the revenue level and to add a definition for small government, which would be municipalities with populations less than 50,000 people. The rule is currently an interagency review, and again, keep in mind that since this has not yet been finalized, the definition may be slightly different from the way that it is presented here today. I will find out a little bit more information on this on slide 24. I'm now transitioning to slide 24, and we've seen the first three checkmark columns of this table in earlier parts of this presentation, but we now have a new column on the far right. So if your substance is subject to any of those listed in the last column, you are not eligible for the small manufacturing exemption. And we are going to transition to slide 25, and I'm going to pass off the presentation to my colleague, Tom Smith, who is going to walk us through using the Substance Registry Service.
Thanks for the introduction and taking us through the first half of the presentation, Meredith. And thanks to all the listeners for continuing to follow along with us manually. And that's not the ideal setup. Now, I'm going to shift our focus a bit, and we'll walk through finding your substance or substances and their status on SRS, which again is the Substance Registry Service. There you'll find whether your substance is on the TOFCA inventory, if it is potentially partially or fully exempt from reporting, and whether or not it is subject to certain TOFCA actions which may impact the reporting requirements. Updates specific to the 2020 CDR will be added to SRS prior to the upcoming reporting period. On slide 26, we'll find what the homepage looks like. Keep in mind also that when you're using the reporting tool, it will search SRS for you. And so though you can search it on your own here before entering information into the reporting tool. Again, that's at epa.gov/SRS. You'll be able to search by list, single chemical, or CAS number, or by multiple chemicals. We'll quickly go through these ways and look at a few example chemicals, but initially we'll go by list on slide 27. You'll have a number of these to choose from. The few examples shown here are the 2016 or 2012 CDR eligible chemicals, as well as those that are partially or fully exempt. On or before June 1st this year, there will be the 2020 CDR lists as well. But we'll start by clicking on the 2016 partially exempt list, for example, on the next slide, number 28. This list is short enough that you can filter it and browse through it in SRS. The chemicals on the partially exempt list require reporting of basic identity and manufacturing information, but not the processing and use information, unless the specific chemical is subject to certain TOFCA actions that we laid out earlier, in which case that chemical would require full reporting. So the 2016 partially exempt list should be the same as that for 2020, but nothing has been added or changed on that list since then. Onto slide 29, we'll see the page that appears when we click on the 2016 full exempt list. These chemicals don't require reporting, but again, with the same caveat, given that they are not also subject to certain TSCA actions we listed previously. And in contrast to the partial exempt list, there have been additions to, there have been additions or changes to this list. So the 2016 full exempt list will not be exactly the same as that for 2020. We're also displaying this page as the results of some searches can be too large to display on SRS. We can, however, download the list, which we'll see on the following slide, number 30. This, for example, is the downloaded list of those chemicals that are fully exempted, again, unless otherwise excluded. As we can see, the output list provides a good amount of information on each chemical that is included. For example, the substance's identities, the common, generic, or the registry names, also identifiers like the CAS number and EPA ID, as well as the effective date or when the substance was officially added to the list, to this list. moving on to slide 31, we'll head back to the SRS homepage. From here, we'll now start walking through searching by an individual substance. Single entry should be the default selection, but if not, we'll click on it and enter a single substance name or CAS number. On slide 32, we'll see our first example chemical. Here you'll see that by searching the CAS number listed in the title, we pulled up the results for ethylene dibromide. when clicking on a substance, we'll see that next step on slide 33. Here we'll see what statutes or regulations a substance may be subject to. This is an example of another substance that you can see is both on the 2016 inventory as well as the partially exempt list, meaning again that it would require reporting manufacturing information but not the processing and use, again, unless subject to certain TSCA actions mentioned earlier. On to slide 34, we'll see another example chemical. Hydrofluoric acid, similarly, is also in the 2016 inventory, and as we can see, it is subject to a variety of other either action statutes or EPA programs as well. Listed are CERCLA, known also as Superfund, a few from the Clean Air Act, and one from the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, or RCRA, at the top. So now that we've gone through determining your need to report an SRS, whether or not you or your chemical may be exempt, on slide 35, we'll shift our attention again, and I'll give an overview of the information to be reported, starting with what's associated with the site. and again, refer to the green text for the changes since the last reporting in 2016. Previously, only the highest level U.S. parent company was reported, but now, if applicable, the highest level foreign parent company will be reported as well. Note that there is a new definition for highest level parent company in CDR's regs at 40 CFR 71.3. This definition now includes multiple scenarios also. Along with the manufacturing or importing site information, the new requirement of the NAICS code associated with that site will be reported. For context, NAICS is the North American Industry Classification System. Submitters will only be required to report one NAICS code, but considering multiple codes may be applicable for a single site, up to three NAICS codes will be allowed to be reported. technical contact information is also required. This should be the person whom EPA may contact for clarification of the information in your CDR submission, someone who can answer questions about the reported substances. Typically, that's a person located at the manufacturing site, the person that is best able to answer such questions. Or it's a person located there that can answer those questions. On to slide 36. After the site associated information, you'll provide manufacturing related data, which includes the chemical identity by name and CAS number, or by generic name and accession number if your chemical is on the confidential portion of the inventory. Also reported in the production volumes are the production volumes for the past 4 years, 2016, 2017, 2018, 2019. For the principal reporting year 2019, much more in-depth information is provided, including whether the volumes are imported or domestically manufactured or both, and if imported, whether the chemical was never physically at the site. Also, the volumes used on site or directly exported from the site. Additional information for 2019 specifically includes the number of workers that are reasonably likely to be exposed, which is to be reported in ranges, the maximum concentration also in percent ranges, physical form and the associated percent production volume, also the indication of whether the chemical is recycled or otherwise used instead of being treated as a waste. So on top of recycling, this element used to include remanufactured, reprocessed, or reused, but we've streamlined the requirement to avoid confusion and refine the information that is being requested. Lastly, there's a new voluntary data element that submitters can choose to report the percent production volume that is a byproduct. There will be a couple options reporting this as your or 100% of the production volume, or using two wide ranges in between. And those are greater than zero but less than 50%, or greater than or equal to 50% but less than zero, or less than 100%. Note also that this isn't asking for the percent of your substance that contains a byproduct, rather it's the percent of the production volume that is a byproduct versus a product. As such, we expect in most cases this will be reported as 0 or 100%. On slide 37, we return back to a familiar table to exhibit a few examples reporting scenarios per chemical that a single company would come across when determining the need to submit manufacturing information as well as processing use. Chemical A requires full reporting, including processing and use, on the 2019 volume of 26,000, while B only requires reporting for the manufacturer because the 2019, the principal reporting year production volume is zero. Chemical C doesn't meet the threshold for any year, so it doesn't require reporting, manufacturing or processing and use. And with chemical D, we're illustrating quite a few things. One, triggering the threshold based on an earlier year, like chemical B, due to the 2017 volume. And two, triggering with a lower threshold because of the Section 6 rule. And three, the need to report the full information on a year, the principal reporting year, even though that year 2019's volume is below the threshold. Moving on to slide 38, we'll talk about what this information actually entails. So as we've already indicated, processing and use related data is required if meeting the threshold, the regular or reduced, unless otherwise exempted. And as you can see, there's a lot of green here, so we'll focus on some of the processing and use related changes. Reporting the function category will now be required for commercial and consumer products as well, not just for the industrial processing and use. And we're phasing in the replacement of the CDR industrial function and commercial consumer product categories product use codes with codes based on the OECD function, product, and article use categories. I'll be referring to these just as the OECD-based codes. These will be familiar for companies that also report internationally and helpful for EPA to synthesize data with other programs that also collect OECD information. So by phasing in, we mean that during the upcoming 2020 CDR submission period, reporting using the OECD-based codes is only required for chemicals designated by EPA as high priority for risk evaluation. The full list of these chemicals can be found at the displayed URL here and will be shown in a few slides also. For all other chemicals, to allow reporters time to familiarize themselves with the OECD-based codes, they may use either these or the current CDR codes, the same as those used in 2016. Reporting using the OECD-based codes will also be fully implemented and required for all chemicals during the 2024 CDR submission period. In other words, these codes will be phased in completely at that point. Now on to slide 39 to see the rest of the required processing and use information. Looking at the first table on the industrial side of things, you'll report the type of processing and use operation, the sector, functional use, and the associated percent production volume, number of workers, and number of sites. And looking at the bottom table on the consumer commercial side, you'll report product category, whether the use is consumer, commercial, or both, functional use, whether used in products intended for use by children, and the associated percent production volume, max concentration, and the number of commercial workers. To reiterate on each of the circled reporting elements, functional use for commercial consumer products in the bottom table is a new data element, and the other two are not new elements, but they're the others impacted by the phase-in of the new OECD-based codes. Now, for a little more context, one combination of the first three elements in the top table, industrial type, sector, and function, is considered a unique exposure scenario. The same goes for the combination of the first four consumer commercial use elements in the bottom table, which together also amount to a unique exposure scenario. For example, each of these scenarios tie into a specific condition of use for a chemical. Now on to slide 40. Here we just have a snapshot of the available function categories that you can use. We can see that the new OECD-based codes are listed in column A and are associated or crosswalked with the current CDR codes in column B. The table of product categories, which is not shown in this presentation, are displayed similarly with a column A and the connection to column B. These full crosswalk tables can be found in the rule as well as the 2020 instructions for reporting, which will be available in the rules docket and on the website. On to slide 41 for another table that I mentioned earlier. Here is the list of the 20 high priority chemicals designated for risk evaluation. Again, if you're reporting any of these substances, you are required to use the OECD-based codes. And if reporting any other substances, you're allowed to, but not required to use the new OECD-based codes. Again, these are the codes that were displayed in column A. Moving to slide 42, and here we want to reemphasize a few things. Reporting is site-specific, meaning there is one form U per site, which could have one or many chemical substance reports. So that's each chemical reported by that site. So again, for some perspective, there were about 8,700 chemicals reported in 2016, but around 42,500 chemical reports as a number of, um, as a number of sites were manufacturing the same chemicals. We also want to stress that the reporting standard is known to or reasonably ascertainable by for all data. That term or phrase is defined at 40 CFR 704.3 and means all information in a person's possession or control, plus all information that a reasonable person similarly situated might be expected to possess, control, or know. Generally, this is the information known by management or supervisory employees of the submitter. More in-depth examples of this type of information or standard can be found in the instructions for reporting as well. On to slide 43, we'll go over some of the changes associated with making confidentiality claims. The TSCA amendments in June 2016 required substantiation for most confidentiality claims. And now upfront substantiation is required for all claims of confidentiality at the time they are made, except for production volume, which includes 5 separate data elements, 1 per year, 2016 to 2018, plus domestically manufactured and imported volumes for 2019. Also, supplier, trade name, and formulation information associated with the joint submissions don't require substantiation. The substantiation questions and certification statement have also been updated. In general use, data elements can no longer be claimed as confidential. Specific elements are listed here for processing and use, either the industrial or the consumer commercial use. Moving on to slide 44 to talk about requirements for importers. Under TSCA, manufacturer includes import, and importers have much of the same requirements, but have a few additional factors to consider. Site is defined for importers in 40 CFR 711.3 and is the U.S. location of the unit directly responsible for importing, and that must be a U.S. address, even if it is not, even if it is for an agent acting for the importer. An importer will indicate whether each imported chemical is never physically present at the reporting site, one of the elements I mentioned previously. And if a mixture is imported, the importer reports the individual chemical components of the mixture, including the percent composition. A joint submission with the supplier is used when the chemical identity or mixture composition is unknown. And one of the new requirements for imported mixtures, the secondary submitter of a joint submission reports the function of the chemical within the mixture. Lastly, imported articles are exempt under 40 CFR 711.10B. On to slide 45, when identifying your imported substance and determining its requirements, For sources of composition information, you can refer to the Material Safety Data Sheet, or MSDS, or the Safety Data Sheet, SDS, or the supplier to provide composition information. If composition information is claimed as confidential, you can ask your supplier to provide the information directly to EPA. And one of the new capabilities for joint submissions, both the primary and secondary submitters are able to identify parts of their submission as confidential. And similar to domestic manufacturer, use known or reasonably ascertainable information to determine whether your production volume triggers reporting. For imported mixtures, that would be the overall production volume of the chemical from each source, including from different imported mixtures or manufactured volumes. And again, you can ask your supplier or refer to the MSDS or SDS for composition information. Moving on to slide 46, we'll shift to information specific to byproducts. Now I'll provide a background there and then transition to the new byproduct-specific exemptions. A byproduct is a substance produced without a separate commercial intent during the manufacture, processing, use, or disposal of another chemical substance or mixture. These are typically manufactured for a commercial purpose and reportable when used for a non-exempt commercial purpose. On slide 47, we'll talk about the first byproduct-specific exemption. So EPA will now exempt specifically listed byproducts that are recycled or used in physically enclosed systems in a site-limited manner and when the site is reporting the byproduct or another substance from the same overall manufacturing process. By site-limited, meaning the byproduct remains on-site after manufacture and if processed. The industries and byproducts that were listed and eligible for this exemption are cement kiln dust from Portland Cement Manufacturer and black liquor and calcium carbonate from the Kraft pulping cycle. Moving on to slide 48, as part of this exemption, a petition process was implemented to identify additional industries and byproducts that meet these criteria. The considerations for the petition process follow the criteria I mentioned in the previous slide, as well as whether or not EPA may have a current interest in the byproduct. Note that there is not time to submit a petition for the 2020 submission period, but petitions for consideration for the 2024 submission period will be due before December 31st, 2022. On slide 49, we'll move on to the second exemption. This exemption is for byproducts that are generated in equipment that is not integral to the production process. The equipment we're referring to specifically is pollution control and boiler equipment. For context, an integral process for the purposes of this exemption is the portion of the manufacturing process that is chemically necessary or provides primary operational support for the production of the intended product. And for a few examples of what equipment is likely to be integral or non-integral, reverberatory furnaces used for smelting and utilities using boilers to produce electricity as a product would be considered integral to the production process, whereas sites using boilers to produce heat or electricity for their facility but not as a product would not be considered integral. Examples of pollution control equipment that is likely to be non-integral includes flue gas desulfurization and selective catalytic reduction systems, both types of air pollution control, as well as, for instance, when a byproduct is produced while treating wastewater from cleaning tanks from a manufacturer's production process, form of water treatment. These are not listed here, but examples can also be found in the 2020 instructions when those are made available. And on slide 50, we'll shift to talking about co-manufactured chemicals. The reporting mechanism for co-manufacturing has been updated in the past. In the past, this was referred to as toll manufacturing. For a little background, a co-manufacturing relationship occurs when a chemical substance manufactured other than by import is produced exclusively for another person who contracts for such production. the contracting company directs this process. Note that the co-manufactured reports are done as part of the overall Form U. It does not require a separate report. So using the first new reporting methodology, the contracting company initiates the co-manufactured chemical report and notifies the producing company using the ECR Web reporting tool, with both the contracting company and producing company reporting their own production volume and the contracting company reporting chemical identity and the processing and use information, and the producing company reporting all of the manufacturing information. On slide 51, using the second new reporting methodology, the contracting and producing company, upon written agreement, work together to complete the reporting. In this scenario, the producing company initiates and completes the reporting, providing exposure-related manufacturing information, while the contracting company provides additional information as needed to the producing company. Although the producing company submits the report, both parties are responsible for the report. On slide 52, we'll shift our focus again. So to finish out this portion of the presentation, and now that we've completed going over the regulatory updates, I'm going to walk us through a number of our non-regulatory updates. These are all intended to improve and streamline the reporting process and can be found on slide 53. There are a variety of IT and functionality enhancements that are to be incorporated into the reporting tool. This includes a new application platform that lags less and has faster validations, a streamlined CVI substantiation process, auto-filling data from 2016 submissions, and improving the process of uploading data. So in 2016, there were issues with uploading from an XML file, so now the reasons for failures will actually be explained. We also will be uploading data, or will also allow uploading data by CSV file. And agent role has also been added to make the reporting process more versatile or flexible. Previously, there were just two roles. Moving on to slide 54. Previously, there were just two roles. The authorized official who creates, signs, and submits the form, and support people who help to fill in the detail of the form. Looking at the table, we can see that the support person only has the capability of editing the form. As requested, the agent role has been added, which is modeled after the new chemicals program and the PMN submission process. Agents will have the ability or access to do the following in this middle column of the table, which includes editing, unlocking, and providing amendments to the original created form. On slide 55, I'll walk us through some of the additional resources you can refer to when making CDR submissions. So we are in the process of updating all of the 2016 guidance documents, including the various fact sheets. On slide 56, we'll see where you can find this updated guidance. For the simplest resource, you can visit the CDR page where the updated information and guidance that I mentioned will be posted as it is developed. There you'll be able to find the instructions for reporting and CDR's frequently asked questions, both which have been updated to reflect the rules changes to the reporting requirements, as well as any of the very informative industry-specific fact sheets. And lastly, reporting-related questions can be sent to ECR web at epa.gov. On slide 57, this lists that we'll have a break for a Q&A session, but to make sure we get through both presentations fully, we'd like to postpone questions until we finish the reporting tool demo. Before handing it over to Carolina Falaye to provide that demo, I'll pass it back to Meredith for a quick note before we move on.
Thank you, Tom. And we've now completed the first half of today's webinar. So we've completed the first slide deck, which on the website is the presentation one. We're now transitioning to presentation two, which is part two of the webinar. The title page on that set of slides says 2020 Chemical Data Reporting ECDR Web Reporting Tool Demonstration. So again, we've completed the first slide deck, and you need to move on to the second slide deck, which is available on our website. And I'm now going to pass it off to Carolina. Thank you.
Thank you, Meredith. This is Carolina Falaye, representing CGI Federal. We have been working with EPA for the past year to understand and implement the CDR new requirements, both from the rules perspective as well as the enhancement and modernization of the tool. I'm now on slide number one, but we're going to move to the quick disclaimer. So the screenshots that you will find in this presentation may change in the real application once we go to production, but these are pretty similar to what we have currently. I'm now on slide number two, which is the agenda. We'll go over the central data exchange registration and form management, as well as completing the Form U, which includes the company and site information, and particular information about the chemicals and how different chemicals can be reported. We have tried to provide a more usable user interface that you can, that we will, the interface will guide you through the different scenarios and how to report the chemical depending on the relationships for the production of the chemical. We'll also go over the bulk chemical upload functionality, the CBI substantiation implementation, the submission process, and the secondary and tertiary forms. I am now on slide three, which has the central data exchange portal, which allows us access to the TASCA applications. The user guide for CDX contains the newly added roads for the primary agent consultant and secondary agent consultant and the different privileges and users that they have. Slide number four contains the different roles and how once you have access to the CDX portal, you can select the use that you need to perform the activities in the application. For the purpose of this presentation, we'll go over the primary authorized official. So some of these screens will not be available for other supports like different roles within the application. I'm moving on now to slide number five, and going forward, you will have two options on the chemical information submission system dropdown. One will be for you to access your old data from 2016, and the new one will be marked as 2020. Once the user selects the OK button, slide number six displays the home page that the user see once they've logged into the CDR application. This contains a list of the sites that are registered under the organization the user registered and logged in for. The Create button will allow you to start the form. As a primary authorized official, you can create the form and assign the users in the User Management tab listed on the top left of the page. And once the form has been created, the pencil icon will display, which allows you to make edits to the form or to your users assigned, like the support or the primary authorized, primary agent consultant, sorry, to make modifications to that form. Once the form has been submitted, the bottom test facility 999 displays the option that you have to download the copy of record or the XML file, as well as the lock, which will allow you to make amendments once the submission has been completed. I'm moving now to slide number seven. On that homepage, you will also find a list of resources that will guide you through more additional information about the regulatory information, the active and inactive rules for the TASCA inventory, and the CBI substantiation frequent questions. On the right-hand side, you'll have the description of the role that you have logged in as and the different abilities and privilege that you have as under that role. Slide number eight, once you have created the or select the create new form, you will be required to create a passphrase. One of the things we have added in this update is the ability to have a hint to help you remind or remember what the passphrase was. We do recommend that you treat this passphrase as a security question or security access key, so the hint shouldn't be your passphrase. As of right now on this mock-up, we don't have the ability to reset that passphrase, but we are working on it. Slide number 9 will give us just the introduction to the company and site information, which is the overview part of the form. If you register as a U.S. or domestic company, your information will be displayed, and with the information provided and during your registration, you can enter your company DNB number and the county or parish and save that information. Slide number 11 shows once you have saved that domestic company, you have the option to add a foreign parent company if that is necessary. If you register under a foreign company, the process will be the opposite, where you would see the foreign company information first, and once you have saved that information, you are required to enter a domestic company before you can proceed. Once the user selects that continue button on slide 11, we'll move on to slide 12, where you will see the site information. As Tom mentioned before, we have added the ability to provide your NAICS codes. Up to 3 codes can be added with a classification, whether it is for manufacturer, import, or both. Slide number 13 guides us to that process where the user will select the NAICS code from the drop-down. This is connected or related to the national North American industry classification system. So the link under the header will guide you through that website so that you can identify which code corresponds to your industry. And then the activity classification will have the 3 options to manufacture, import, or both. Once you select the add to list, slide 14 shows how the NAICS codes will be listed under the site information. Once the user selects the continue button, we'll go over slide 15, which details the chemical information and how each chemical can be reported as. The first step is a chemical summary where all your chemicals will display. You have the ability to sort by any of the columns or search by using that search functionality. Once you select the Add Chemical button will guide you through the steps to add your chemical manually, or the bulk chemical upload will guide you through the process of using either an XML file or an XLXS, which is an Excel file. We'll go first over the steps of adding the chemical manually. So when the user selects the Add Chemical in slide 16, slide 17 will display several steps. So one of them is first identifying whether you know the identity of the substance or if you are providing a join submitted, the ability to enter that information for you, or if you are just producing that chemical for somebody else. In this scenario, we'll go with the fact that we do know the chemical identity, and so the user will select the click here to add chemical. That is a hyperlink, and select the and the hyperlink will guide us through the steps on slide 18 onward. So I'm now on slide 18, where the user can select by using the Catherine number or the accession number if the chemical is in the confidential portion of the TSCA inventory. In this case, I selected an accession number. That when I select the search button, slide 19 will display that the system is checking with SRS. And in slide 20, we'll receive the list of results. If you search by generic name or the EPA inventory flag, you may find multiple results. So you need to select the radio button on the far left to select which is the correct chemical identity. Once you have done that, the Save Chemical button will be enabled, and slide 21 shows how the chemical is now displayed on the chemical identity page. As you can see, you can provide your chemical alias, but also because this chemical was in the confidential portion of the task inventory, you must select one of the statements according to what you need to do. One is to maintain the existing claim of the confidentiality of the chemical substance identity as listed on the confidential portion of the task inventory, or the second option is not to maintain that claim. All the data elements that you can claim as confidential business information or CBI will have a corresponding checkbox. In this case, you can claim the company, site, or technical contact information as CBI by selecting one or all of those checkboxes. Once the user selects the continue button, slide 22 will display for the user to enter the corresponding technical contact information. This should be someone who can answer questions about that particular chemical in this site. Slide 23 shows the fields that you must provide. You can copy from CDX, which will bring in the information of the user that is registered, filling out the form, or you can type a new one. Once the user select the Save button, slide 24 shows the technical contact information listed on that table. At this point, the user can create multiple chemicals and then assign them as he's entering the following chemicals, or can also select a default technical contact that will carry over for each additional chemical. Once the user selects the continue button, slide 25 shows the manufacturing information page. In this case, the user can provide the total production volumes of the prior or previous years from 2016 through 2018 and make a selection for which or how the chemical was produced for 2019. And the first option is my site is reporting the production or end use of the chemical. This implies this would apply for chemicals that the company knows the chemical identity or they have imported or generated a joint submission. And then the second option would be my company contracted a manufacturer to produce the chemical at their site. And the third option is in case that the company also produced for someone else. So in this case, we'll follow up with the first scenario in slide 26, which is I am reporting as a manufacturer or importing company. In that case, the user select in slide 27, this my site is reporting the production and use of the chemical. This provides the required information on whether the chemical was manufactured, import, and all the required production volume information, as well as the exposure, and in slide 28, the physical form. Slide 29 will show the different fields that we would collect for a contracting company. So in case that your company contracted a producing company or is in a co-manufacturing relationship, the contracting company will provide the information for the producing company. So slide 30, we have a list of the information that the contracting company must provide, such as the chemical name, the 2019 contracted production volume, whether the volume was contracted was never physically at site, and the producing company information. Slide 31 shows how the contracting company will notify the producing company via email, providing a unique identifier for the producing company to then report their information on behalf of the contracting company. Slide 32 is just an extension of that email and shows the body of the email and how they would send out that information. In slide 33, we will cover how that producing company would then complete their part of the form on behalf of the contracting company. In that case, we'll go back to how the producing company would select the no, I am a producing company, on slide 34. Slide 35 will show where the user could add the unique identifier provided in the previous slides and select the populate company, contracting company, which will display and populate the information related to that table. If the contracting company selected that they wanted to make that relationship confidential, the column called relationship with CVI will be marked as yes. Then the producing company must provide a chemical alias, the produced volume, the percentage of the total production volume by weight that was manufactured as byproduct. And I'm moving on to slide 36 for the additional information they need to provide, which are related to the exposure-related information and the physical form. Once the user, the producing company, selects the continue button, they can save that information, and that would be their part for that contracted chemical. Slide 37 will quickly go over the scenario where the user is or the company is a manufacturer for an imported substance. So the user would select the "No, I am an importer" option and enter the information for the secondary company that will provide the chemical identity information. Slide 39 shows the bottom part of that page, which is the generation of that email, which will contain the unique identifier. Slide 39, just the body of the email. Slide 40, the body of the email. And once the information has been provided for the manufacturing, the contracting company and the manufacturing company, or the manufacturing company, they will be required to provide the uses for the chemical. So they will move on to the industrial processing and use page. In slide 42, we display how the user would enter each use one at a time, up to 10, selecting the type of process of processor use, the sectors, function category, percent production volume, number of sites, and number of workers. A change from 2016 is before all of these items were allowed to be claimed CBI, but for 2020 we're only restricting it to be the percent production volume, number of sites, and number of workers. Each drop-down has the ability for you to search using the code or the description. Slide 43 displays that a little bit better, where you can see a list of the codes. This list will include the newly added F codes as well as the previous reporting codes, U codes. Slide 44 shows a similar concept that was used for the consumer and commercial use. Slide 45 has the different selections that need to be made to add each use that are for consumer or commercial. Again, the function category was updated to include the C codes as well as the CC codes. One thing to mention before I move on from the uses is for the high visibility chemicals, we have limited the function category to display only the F codes, but all others you can select from F or U codes. Moving on to slide 47, the bulk chemical upload functionality, we will provide the ability to upload the XML for 2016 if you have it. We won't be able to reset your passphrase to retrieve those, but if you have already your passphrase or you have downloaded them from previous reporting period, then you can use those to upload. We will provide the 2020 XML as well as the CSV file. In slide 48, this will be the page where you can select the file once you have compiled the information. And slide 49 will have a couple of validations run. So before we will verify if you're uploading an XML file from 2016, we'll compare it to the schema that the system will accept, and we'll provide you with specific lines or rows where we have identified any errors with the formatting of the file. Once that has been fixed and you upload the corrected file, we will run a validation against SRS to make sure that the chemicals reported match and are found in SRS. Once that has been completed, you'll see slide 49 that has the successfully uploaded and the count of chemicals that were uploaded in that file. You can select the Save Chemical Information button on that page. Slide 50 is a quick display of how an error or a chemical that is not found in SRS will display, so you can quickly identify the specific chemical that needs to be revised. Slide 51 will walk us through the process of providing the CBI substantiation. So once all your chemicals have been added, then the system will identify those claims that will require CBI substantiation, and those chemicals will be listed on the CBI substantiation review tab. The plus sign will expand each chemical, and the paper-over-paper copy icon would allow you to copy the substantiations from one chemical to the next, and we'll go over this on the following slides. Slide 53 shows how once you expand the chemical, we have this different sections that you filled in the form, and each section has URLs or links to the information that was claimed confidential. In this case, we have the company information. On the right-hand side, we have the chemical that we're looking at and the data element that we will be substantiating. The questions are listed for each item that was claimed CBI. So on the right-hand side, you will see the claims that are general claims. So each element will require the substantiation for these six questions. Slide 54 shows how once you have provided all those answers to the questions, the substantiation questions, and everything has been validated, your chemical will be on a good status, which is a green check. Slide 54 shows how you can potentially use some of those answers and copy them over to the next chemical. In this case, we are editing 126013. And so you will see that editing chemical for substantiation on the top or right hand of the page. And then selecting from this drop down in slide 66 will show which chemicals have been substantiated and you can use as reference to copy from. In slide 67, once you select the chemical that you think will have the most information that you can reuse, we will have a couple of options. One of them, the first one, is copy substantiations. This functionality will allow you to copy from the chemical selected to the current chemical that you're editing, or copy substantiation to all will use those answers and copy them over to all the chemicals that have any CBI claim. Please note that if there are claims that were not part of the first chemical, they will be still required to be answered or substantiated in the second chemical or the other chemicals, depending on how you did the copy. Slide 58 will show a good example where most of the substantiations from the first chemical selected mapped to the last chemical, in this case, the trade product one. So both of those are good in good standing from a CBI substantiation standpoint. But our accession number, the chemical in the middle, 126013, will need some reviewing. slide 59 will take us over the process to identify what is missing. So once you expand with a plus sign, you will see that the chemical identification page has 2 claims out of 6 possible, but it sounds like it's missing something. So in slide 60, you'll see that the company information has a little check containing or showing that the substantiation has been provided, but the chemical substance identity is missing. So when you select that, you will see a couple of additional questions that are specific to the chemical identity claims and the additional general claims. In slide 61, you'll see that now all your chemicals are in good standing. They all have been substantiated, and you can move on with the submission process. So slide 62 will take us onwards. It will take us through the submission process. Once you have all your form ready to go, the next step will be to confirm that you are the submitted official identified for this form. You can claim your information as CBI, provide your position, and once you select the bottom checkbox to confirm that you are the legally responsible party for submitting the form, the Start Submission Process button will become available. Slide 65 will take you to the certification for the CBI substantiation claims. One thing to note, and we don't have them on the slides, is you will be prompted that the substantiations are final at the time of submission. So if you have any doubts, we recommend that you wait until you confirm that all your CBI claims are in good standing and that everything that you want to claim CBI has been marked as such, because once you submit, you won't be able to go back and change your selections. Slide 66 is the CDR certification statement. Once you certify, slide 66 will provide a global validation to ensure everything was in place and everything that is required is provided. Slide 68 will give you the opportunity to download the draft PDF. This is not to be sent to EPA and is not a final submission. And then the final submission can be downloaded via the download copy of record once the submission has been completed. Selecting the sign and encrypt submit button will guide you through the Cromer process that secures and submits the form to EPA. That is demonstrated on slide 69. Slide 70 has the steps that Cromer will require, which is the entering the password from CDX and then verifying with your 521 question and selecting the sign button. That will complete the submission of the primary form. Once the form has migrated and EPA has received it, you will see a case number assigned to your form on the home page. Slide 71 will take us over the secondary and tertiary form. I'm now on slide 72, and so this will get us using the secondary authorized official role. Slide 73, you'll notice that this is a little bit different from the primary in the sense that they have only one form to report per year and not multiple sites. They also have the resource information and the secondary or the user information on the right-hand side. In this case, they would provide a trade product identification that they have agreed upon with the contracting or the manufacturing company, and then provide all the substances that make that trade product. On the bottom half of that page, we'll have the ability to enter the unique identifier and populate that primary company or company's information. Slide 76 will allow us to have some questions and answers, so I'm passing it back to Meredith. Thank you for listening.
Great. Thank you so much, Carolina. It looks like we have plenty of time for questions today. But before we transition to a question and answer section, I just want to point out two things. First, we have a slide correction on the first slide deck. If you go to slide 54, this is the ECDR management and user roles. We just want to point out that the agent role also has the functionality of being able to create the form and set the passcode. So again, this is on slide 54. The agent role can also create the form and set the password. And one other thing we would like to point out is the CDR revisions rule actually published today. So if you're interested in reading more in depth about the revisions rule, you can find the rule itself and then also accompanying documents at regulations.gov. I have the docket number here. It's EPA HQ OPPT 2018-0321. Again, that's EPA HQ OPPT 2018-0321. So again, this was just published today, and we encourage you to get a head start and review that rule in preparation for the CDR reporting period. And with that, I'm going to pass it over to our operator, who is going to be helping open lines for the question and answer section, and Susan Sharkey, who is also in our office in the Office of Pollution Prevention and Toxics, will take the lead on responding to questions from participants. And thank you again for following along with the slides and engaging with the webinar up to this point. Thanks.
At this time, I would like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. Again, that is star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. We have our first question. Please state your first and last name. Your line is open.
David Hahn. On slide deck one, slide 21 said the reporting was yes. On slide 37, it was no. Can you explain the difference for that chemical?
Okay, let me take a quick look at the two pages. The first one was on slide 21.
Yes.
And it's, which chemical are you talking about?
Chemical B is yes.
Chemical B reporting is yes because it hit the production volume of 34,000. And then on the second slide was which number?
37. That same chemical B is now no. I don't understand the difference.
Oh, so this... we added another column to the table. There's the column on the far right is associated with just the processing and use information. The column second from the right is reporting required, and that remains yes, because that the production volume was triggered in 2017. It's over 25,000 pounds. So that chemical does need to be reported. However, because the production volume in 2019 is zero, the processing and use portion of the information is reported only for the 2019 production volume. Because that's zero, there is no processing use information to be reported.
Yeah. Okay, I understand. I misread where the no was. Thank you.
Certainly.
We have our next question. Please state your first and last name. Your line is open.
James Lee. So I have similar question for slide deck. On the first slide deck page is 21 and 37. So what I'm trying to figure out is on 21, it says for chemical, what is it? Let's go back to that slide. For A and B, reporting are required, but do you report on every single year, even though the production volume is below 25,000, or do you report only on the year that exceeded the threshold?
You report for all of the years.
Okay.
So there's two different things to consider. First is whether you trigger the need to report. And so you look at each individual year and see if in any year you exceed the applicable threshold for that chemical. If you exceed the threshold in any of those years, then you report information for all of the years.
Okay. Even though the production volume is zero, you report on that year, like 2016, let's say, for example, on chemical B.
Right. And in that case, you would report zero.
Okay. Got you. But then you're saying that for production or the processing and use information, only the principal reporting year, which is 2019, matters.
Correct. And that's also true for other manufacturing information that you report only for the principal reporting year. The only information you report for the 2016, 2017, and 2018 is the total production volume for that chemical for that year.
Okay. And that goes the same for, you know, the chemicals that are under some kind of TSCA order, you know, 4, 5, and 6. It's 2,500 threshold limit, but that only applies for production processing and use information. That only applies if 2019 principal year is triggered.
If there is any production in 2019, then you report the processing use information. And that's true even if the production volume in 2019 is below the threshold and you were triggered, the reporting was triggered by a different year, you would still report the processing use information. So if you look at, say, chemical D, the reporting was triggered for the year 2017 with the 3,000 pounds. And there's only 1,200 pounds in 2019. So you would report the processing use information for that 1,200 pounds.
Oh, okay, okay. So the processing and use information doesn't apply to the chemicals that are under the subject of 4, 5, and 6 orders.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Okay. Got it.
Okay.
Thank you.
We have our next question coming from the line of Diane Welch. Your line is open.
I have a question on the second presentation talking about the secondary and tertiary forms. How do I know whether or not I have to submit those? Is that only if I'm submitting as part of like my parent company, or how does that work?
So the secondary and tertiary forms are mostly associated with imported chemicals. When you don't know the composition of the substance that's being imported and you're asking your foreign supplier to provide that information. If you as the primary or if you as the importer know the chemical identity of the chemicals, then there's no need to use the secondary form. The tertiary form only comes in when the foreign supplier doesn't know the information either and has to go to another party to receive it, to be able to supply the information.
Okay, so as long as I have the chemical information, I don't have to worry about the secondary and tertiary forms.
That's correct.
Okay.
Next question.
We have our next question coming from the line of Kristen Miller. Your line is open.
Hi. I have a question. When I'm in the CDX database, when I add a program and service and I use the submissions for chemical safety and pesticides program, my facility is already in there because of TRI reporting. Do I use the same facility number to add this additional reporting service?
Carolina, can you answer that one, please?
Yes. So, yes, it should be the same facility that you're reporting for. That was
okay,
that
so
if
what,
you log in, sorry. If you log into CDR, you will see that side, we call it in CDR, that side listed on your homepage.
Okay. Yeah, it's not there. And when I go to search for it, I suppose I just have to call the help desk then and get some direct help. Okay, thank you.
We have our next question coming from the line of Radmila Petrovic. Your line is open.
Hello. I have several questions. First one is related to slide 36, and it is about volume directly exported from reporting sites. Our substance that we produce is further mixed with another additive and further exported as mixture. Do we report only the single substance volume or total volume of the mixture?
So if I understand correctly, you are manufacturing a substance that at the same site you're mixing it with another substance before exporting it. Is that correct?
Correct. Yes.
So you would report the chemical that you manufactured. You would then, in the processing and use, because you are mixing it with another substance, you are not, it does not fall into the direct export. You would, in the processing and use information, fill out the information associated with incorporating the substance into a mixture. And that's what you would report. If the other substance that you're mixing it with is one that you domestically purchased, and
yes,
so that you're not a manufacturer, then you have no reporting requirements for that substance.
Okay. So my export is, when it says volume directly exported from reporting site, so I would use only the amount that we actually produce, not the total
for
export.
Right, but you don't have, because you are processing it on your site by mixing it with another substance, you are not directly exporting it from your site.
Okay.
You're processing it first. Okay.
Okay. Next question is about slide 50, and it is related to contract manufacturing. We're a toller or toll manufacturer, and the question is, in the past, our contracting companies wanted to take care of everything. And question, is that still an option, or do we have to go through the two-step reporting process?
We do not have an option for the contracting company to report all of the information.
Okay. Okay. Now, what if our contracting company is no longer in the business? How do we report? Because on occasion we run to some small companies and they're no longer in the business. We
right.
need to report somebody, but we have no contact with, which did happen in the past. When we don't have a contact name, we don't even know if they're not basically reporting anything. So what do we do in a situation like that?
Well, as the producing company, you can report all of the information yourself.
But let's say if I do not know the chemical, let's say we're making a complex polymer mixture, and we really don't know what the polymer involved, whether it is reportable or not, and we don't know the chemical composition. We just know the ingredients that go in, but we don't know the final cast number of the the polymer that we are making. So we really don't know whether it is, should it be reported or not.
The best in that situation, the best path forward would be to ask us directly so that we can get into some more details about it. But one thing, for the most part, polymers are exempted from the need to report. It's not, there are some exceptions to that.
Okay. Next question, is the scrap quantity integral part of the produced quantity? Let's say I'm making 100,000 pounds of a chemical A, but basically a batch failed, on a 50,000 failed. So is my produced quantity together scrap and the good material, or just the good material that is actually end up in a commerce?
Are you there's a couple of different options there. If you are if the substance if the substance that you're that you manufactured that is scrap is actually a different substance, then it would not be counted as part of the total volume that you have, because it's actually a different substance. If it has the same substance identity, I need to think about the answer to that question.
Okay.
So can you
send
it? Yeah, if you can send it to me, to ecvrweb@epa.gov, I can get the answer back to you.
Okay, and I have one more last question about importing. What if the manufacturer is actually in Europe or Asia? What are we supposed to do? We are the importer, but we do not know the trade secret, the chemical composition is trade secret. So what do we do in a situation when a manufacturer who knows the exact component of the material, or, I mean, whether it's a substance or a mixture?
In that situation, you would make use of the joint reporting. You would be the primary submitter, and when you are filling out your reporting form, you would be able to send a notice to your foreign supplier and ask them to complete the secondary reporting form. And they would be able to go in and register with CDX and obtain the secondary form and then submit the information directly to EPA. And that protects their confidentiality of the confidentiality of their composition, but gives EPA the information needed for the work we're doing.
And would we be held responsible if they do not reply by a certain date?
We encourage you to encourage them to respond. And as long as you document the fact that you have made efforts to do so, such as by sending a request to them through the reporting tool, then you would be fine.
Okay. Thank you.
Next question.
We have our next question from the line of Trev Bahal. Your line is open.
Hi, Trev, are you there? Okay, please move on to the next question.
We have our next question from the line of Susan Zellers. Your line is open.
Yes, I'm referring to slide 49 in the first slide deck, where Mr. Smith had made a comment about if electricity was generated and it was used on site, it was one scenario, but if it was sold off-site, it was a different scenario. Can you elaborate on that a little more?
Yes. In the situation where the electricity is produced as a product, then any of the substances associated with that production of the product are considered part of the integral process of manufacturing the electricity, and therefore would not be eligible for this exemption. However, if you have the situation where you are producing it for your own use, it's considered not integral to the production of your products, which presumably is something other than the electricity.
Right, right. And, yeah, in all cases, the electric generation is a totally separate function. And so in our situation, I feel like it's not integral, even though we do export some electricity.
If you would like to delve into it in a little more detail, we can do that offline.
All right, that's fine. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And next question.
We have our next question from the line of Jerome Nest. Your line is open.
Hello. Hey, I was wanted to get some clarification on, I think it was slide 21. Once again, so basically, as long as you've broken the threshold for the 3-year period, you still have to report, and whatever amount you have for the preceding or the years, then you're going to report that also. But as long as you break the threshold,
that's correct. Yeah.
Okay, that's all I need to know. Thank you so much. Your presentation was outstanding.
Hey, thank you, Jerome.
Bye-bye.
We have our next question from the line of Ping Li. Your line is open.
Hi, how are you? So one of my questions is regarding to the co-factoring, the co-manufacturer. So we are a company that we have a partner with the overseas manufacturer, and we import the chemical to the U.S., but we never participate in the manufacturing process. So if we have to report a chemical, do we report it as a contracting company or as an importer?
In that situation, you would report it as the importer. For CDR purposes, the co-manufacturing is associated with domestic manufacturing and not import.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, thank you, and that's all I have.
Okay, great.
We have our next question. Please state your first and last name. Your line is open. To the person who hit star 1, your line is open.
Hi, this is Lorraine Anderson. I think you've already answered this question, but I want to ask it again about co-manufacturing.
Certainly.
Okay. Okay. So, what in a co-manufacturing scenario? What if the contract company has an agreement with the producing company to submit all reports? Did I understand correctly that only the producing company can submit the CDR report?
There are two different methodologies. One is that the contracting company initiate the report and produce and provide part of the information, but and sends a request to the producing company to report some of the manufacturing related information, or for the producing company to report all of the information, obtaining information from the contracting company outside of the reporting tool as okay. needed.
Okay, so then it would if it's a single reporter scenario, then the producing company would have to report.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
We have our next question coming from the line of Trev Bahal. Your line is open. Hello, Trev. Your line is open. You may ask your question.
Trev, it seems like we're having problems hearing you if you're asking the question. If you could go ahead and email it to ecdrweb@epa.gov, and we can address your question that way.
Moving on to the next question, we have our next question from the line of Matthew Taylor. Your line is open.
This goes back to the previous question about slide 36 with the volume used at reporting site versus directly exported. So if you have a product that's made and then diluted with a different non-manufactured chemical in the same pot and then shipped out as a separate product, does that the original manufactured material, is that 100% use at reporting site, 0% directly exported?
It's right, because you're processing it by turning it into a mixture at your site, and then shipping it off site. So you do have the processing on your site, and it would be use on site.
Okay. And then as a follow up to that, so the use, the use code or whatever for that chemical, does then that be is the use code for that the blending in the industrial setting, or is it the final use code for the finished diluted material?
It would be the incorporation into a product.
The
blending at the site, yeah.
Great, thank you.
Certainly.
We have our next question from the line of Mark Francis. Your line is open.
Yes, my question is in regard to the new byproducts exemptions. Slide 49 of the first slide deck. The question is related to byproducts manufactured in non-integral equipment, pollution control equipment, or boiler equipment as examples. The question is if that applies to byproducts only to byproducts that are actually manufactured or produced within the pollution control equipment, or if it applies to byproducts that are collected by the pollution control equipment. In other words, does it only apply to chemicals if a chemical reaction occurs within the pollution control equipment such that manufacturing, as it is defined, actually occurs within the equipment itself? or does the exemption apply to perhaps where you're just collecting a dust within that pollution control equipment?
No, it's the former, the byproducts that are actually manufactured in the pollution control equipment.
Okay. So if the equipment is just collecting the byproducts, the exemption doesn't apply.
That's correct, because okay. The byproduct would have been produced elsewhere as part of an integral process.
Okay. Thank you. That answers the question.
Okay.
We have our next question from the line of Gil Lesto. Your line is open.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Good. I have a question. I'm struggling with slide 49 also. So if you, for example, we acidulate a product, which we then further distill, during the acidulation, it releases sulfur dioxide, which we capture in a scrubber. That sulfur dioxide that we capture in the scrubber, we then send to a customer who uses it. Is it still exempt if it's made in that pollution control equipment?
I think I would need a little bit more information about that particular scenario. Can you email it to ecdrweb@epa.gov so that we can consider it more directly?
Sure.
Thank you.
Will do.
We have our last question. Please state your first and last name. Your line is open.
Hello?
Hello?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yeah. Can you state your name, please?
Yeah, I'm Sudhakar. My question is, can you please touch on who are required to submit 2020 CDR report? I'm not sure if we are required to submit CDR report. On slide 8, it is mentioned if we manufacture any chemical substance or import any chemical substance and meeting this threshold quantity, then we need to report, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, but we now, when you say import from outside of United States of America, right?
That's correct.
And if we don't directly import, but if we buy any chemical from any supplier within USA, is it considered as import? We don't know if the supplier is importing from outside of USA.
So if you are not the one that is importing the substance, the person responsible for importing the substance is the entity that is required to report. So if you are procuring from a domestic supplier and are not considered an importer of the substance, then you would not need to report, and the person who did the importing of that would have been responsible for reporting. We do have a fact sheet on importers. We have not yet updated it for the 2020 reporting, but we will within the next, it'll be updated before the reporting period starts. But for this aspect of it, you can rely on the 2016 fact sheet for a description of how to determine if you're the importer or not. But there is a definition of importer that you can use.
Yeah, and my next question is, we are not manufacturing any chemical substances, but we use chemicals as part of manufacturing our products. So do we need to report?
you do not need to report for chemicals that you purchase. And depending on the activities when you're using the chemicals, you may end up producing a chemical that is reportable as perhaps a byproduct. So you do need to look at your overall process and see if you are manufacturing anything that does trigger the need to report. Often, if you're, say, just mixing chemicals together and there's no chemical reaction where you're creating a different chemical substance, then you would not trigger the need to report.
Okay. That means we are not required to report the chemicals that we purchase.
That's correct.
Okay. Right. So, is there any contact number in case if we have any questions, we can contact you?
Can you please send an email to ecdrweb@epa.gov? And I have a team of people who can help answer the questions, so it's not just relying on me.
Okay, thank you.
Certainly.
We have our next question from the line of James Lee. Your line is open.
Sorry, me again. One more question about the CBI substantiation. There is a recent rule that gave 8 questions on CBI substantiation. Are those 8 questions going to be on the CDX now, or is it different?
They are going to have a series of questions that need to be answered depending on the data element that you're claiming as confidential. And it's all incorporated. You'll access them as part of the reporting tool when you move through there. If you would like to see them ahead of time, they are in the regulatory text, and you can take a look at the rule that was published today. I don't know. Do you need the docket number?
No, I have it. Another question is, so with the inactive and active reset rule, you know, we have obligation to do to substantiation, you know, CBI question. So do we still need to do those inactive, active, you know, substantiation process, even though we're going to be doing CBI substantiation through CDX?
So each time you submit information to the EPA and claim that information as CBI, then it's considered a new claim and requires a new substantiation. So for the information that you're submitting through CDR, you would need to provide the substantiation.
Okay. So I got to do both for CDR and for the inactive active substantiation rule, you're saying?
Yeah.
Susan, just to add to that, they are captured in 2 different applications, so they are kind of separate. Those will be part of the Section A for the notice of activity, so that's kind of different from CDR. So, yes, you are required to answer those questions separately.
Okay.
We have our last question coming from the line of Trev. Your line is open. Hello to the person who has pressed *1 on a telephone. Your line is open. You may ask your question.
I have a question about, is the agency still treating hydrates as mixtures under this version of the rule?
Yes. Hydrate is still a mixture, so you would report the anhydrous version and not include the water part of the production volume.
Okay, thank you. And second and last, when does the agency anticipate to publish all 2020 guidance documents, instructions, and the sample form U on the 2020 CDR website going forward? Is there a precise date when that might appear?
It will appear by June 1st. We will be putting documents up as we are able to. The draft instructions and a draft form you print out from the reporting tool are currently on the in the docket as part of the ICR addendum that's accessible there.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Thank you to all who have participated in the question and answer section. We have reached the end of our webinar. It's now 3 p.m. and we need to close the line. I appreciate everyone calling in today and for engaging with the slides as well as staying on the line to participate in the question and answer section. If you have any more questions or if you think of anything in the near future, please contact us at ecdrweb@epa.gov. Again, that's E as an elephant, cdrweb@epa.gov, and we will do our best to respond to you there. And thank you to Tom and Susan and Carolina for presenting today on this webinar. I'm going to close out the line and pass this over to the operator.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.